Good morning. We're going to call the meeting to order. Start with a call for a motion and second for approval of the minutes of the regular commission meeting of June 13th, 2018 and the special committee commission meeting of June 29th, 2018.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. We'll ask Curtis for the executive director's report.
Thank you, Madam President. Good morning, commissioners. Stan, I wonder if we could start with a safety message from you, please.
Sure. Well, with the weather getting warm, I think I have the appropriate safety message for today. I want to focus on being smart this summer to stay healthy. One of the skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the United States, and it's also the most preventable. And exposure to ultraviolet rays causes most cases of melanoma, which is the deadliest kind of skin cancer. Unprotected skin can be damaged by the sun's UV rays in as little as 15 minutes. And even if it's cool and cloudy, you still need skin protection. It's the UV rays and not the temperature that does the damage. So to lower your skin cancer risk, protect your skin from the sun and avoid indoor tanning, and plan your sun protection using these tips. Seek shade, especially during later morning through mid-afternoon. Wear clothing that covers your arms and legs. Wear a hat with a wide brim that shades your face, your neck, your head, and ears. Wear sunglasses that block both UVA and UVB rays, and apply broad-spectrum sunscreen with sun protection factor SPF 15 or higher. And remember to reapply that sunscreen at least every 2 hours and after swimming or sweating or toweling off. Another thing to be mindful of is exposure to excessive heat. In 2014, 244 people died in the United States from exposure to excessive heat. And this year already, dozens have already perished in the recent heat wave in the eastern U.S. and in Canada. So exposure to sun combined with physical activity can lead to heat-related illnesses. These include heat cramps, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, which is the most severe. Heat-related illnesses can escalate rapidly, leading to delirium, organ damage, and even death. So be aware and assist those most at risk, which include infants and small children. And interesting, I did not know this, but between Memorial Day and Labor Day, 3 kids die each week of heat stroke in hot automobiles. Others at risk include the elderly, outdoor workers, individuals with heart and circulatory problems, athletes, and people who like to exercise, especially beginners. And also be mindful that your pets are also at risk. So to reduce your risk of heat-related illnesses, limit exposure outdoors during hot days. Air conditioning is the best way to stay cool. Mind your hydration level. Take frequent water breaks every 15 minutes when working or playing outdoors, and don't wait until you're thirsty to do that. Replace salt loss from sweating by drinking electrolyte sport drinks. Wear loose, lightweight, wicking clothing and wide-brimmed hat. Wear sunscreen. Sunburn does affect the body's ability to cool off. And pace yourself when you run or otherwise exert your body. And remember that some medications and alcohol intake can increase your risk to these heat exposures. So be smart this summer for your lifelong health and influence others to practice these widely publicized skin cancer and heat illness mitigation guidelines. That's my message, Curtis.
Thank you, Stan. As a fine aficionado of wide brim hats, thank you for your comments today. Well, today I feel like I'm coming home. These are better days. We heard news yesterday that PDX was once again selected by travelers in the United States as the best airport in America. We're honored and thrilled again, sixth year in a row to receive the award. And I just want to reiterate one more time, it's really many, many hands who win this award for PDX, especially the folks who work every day across the way at the airport. 10,000 people come to work every day at PDX, and this is really their award. So we're really thrilled again this year. We'll be having a bit more celebrating over the summer, as we are wont to do, really focused on those people over at the airport who make it work every day. You may have heard Inside PDX, a new message on the public announcement system. Sadly, not Curtis Robinhold anymore, but Emily Burnside of 10 Barrel Brewing. She's the first woman head brewer in Portland, and it's part of our new effort to include a special guest periodically calling attention to the people that make Portland unique and special, as well as promoting some fantastic regional events like the Oregon Brewers Festival, which starts here in a couple weeks. As a leader in advocating for trade policies that benefit our region, you'll have heard me and other leaders here at the port talking a lot about trade. We're deeply concerned about the trend that appears to be on its way and already underway, impacting in particular Oregon exporters, farmers. We just talked this morning with officers about concerns around cherries and hazelnuts, but also wheat. And I'll just say we're keeping close tabs on it. We haven't really seen immediate impacts in our volumes, but we're really concerned about where this sort of trend might take us. We're engaged pretty directly with our delegation recently in the last couple weeks, talking with Congressman Blumenauer and Bonamici both about trade and the impact of trade on their districts. On the good news side, we've just received news end of last week from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that they are going to spend $3 million to help us with our Levee Ready Columbia program out here along the Columbia. It's great news for us, but also for our many partners out here along the Columbia. Very excited about that. And in other good environmental news, we were awarded the Recycler of the Year for a business or institution by the Association of Oregon Recyclers for our Green Plate pilot program, which tested durable, reusable dishware at PDX. A couple things coming up here. First, tomorrow, we're hosting students from the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, IRCO, as I think you all know, an organization we care deeply about here at the port. It's our third year in a program called Ninth Grade Counts. It helps prepare these students for their transition into high school with a focus on preparation for their career and college. And they'll tour PDX and see many of the diverse careers that are available for folks here in and around our facilities. And then finally, Saturday, to Dan's point about playing on the water, we're helping sponsor the Big Float, a fun community event to encourage the public to use the Willamette River for swimming and other boating opportunities. It's a lot of fun, and we have a lot of port employees who participate every year. So, Madam President, those are my comments.
Thank you, Curtis. I'll call for a motion to accept the Executive Director's report.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. I think we are in the public comment section of our meeting, and we have someone signed up for public comment. You could come forward, please. Thank you.
Excuse me, a business and labor roundtable about the I-5 replacement bridge. As you may know, the Washington legislature asked that a report be completed of the work done on the Columbia River crossing to find out what is still viable, what updates may need to be done if that process gets going again. And then in the 2017 legislative session in Washington State, they put together a committee of eight legislators and invited eight Oregon legislators to talk about, well, what do we do with this information? That committee has met on a couple of occasions. Oregon's been invited and Oregon hasn't come yet. So the intent of this roundtable, which will be at the Red Lion on August 28th in Jansen Beach, is to bring business and labor together to persuade the Oregon legislature to start meeting with this group to figure out what we want to do next. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barber. There's no one else signed up for public comment, so Curtis, if you could introduce the first general discussion item, please.
Great, thank you. Are we going straight to Judith? You ready for us, Judith? Commissioners, as you'll recall, I have been participating since January this year in an ODOT-sponsored Oregon Transportation Commission task force addressing value pricing in the Portland metropolitan area. The origination of this concept for Oregon was really in the 2017 transportation package that instructed the commission to undertake this work. And we have today, Judith is here from ODOT, who actually was at each of these meetings, has done countless public outreach meetings as well on the topic. The idea, and for everyone except Sean, who also was a task force member and a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission still, it really is to just give you a sense of what the big issues are, what the process has been, and to help you understand the questions that are facing the community around value pricing. So Judith, over to you. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the time on your agenda. The presentation that I have today, I had in mind about 30 minutes, and I'll tell you that that can be a little bit challenging. Usually when I'm going to a group for the first time, I'm finding that as we've gone through the process, it needs a little bit more than that. So I'll ask you now to understand I'm going to be pretty brief, and Curtis did a good job of kind of telling you that it's going to be highlighting. But I'm certainly interested in helping with any questions or whatever you may have. Really what I want to do is, like Curtis said, give you a highlight of kind of what we're doing and why and where we are in the process now and what the steps are going forward. And then some of the other questions we can just discuss as you wish. I've given you each a copy of the report, which is pretty short. And if you were to take the full document with the references, it's about 150 pages, or the attachments. It's about 150 pages. But I always try to make sure that those are available, and you know you can have that. But the actual body of the recommendation is in the pages that you have in front of you. So with that, let's see. Here we are. I'll give you a little bit of the legislative context from the state legislature as well as Federal Highway Administration, and how the OTC approached that in the formation of this committee, what their recommendation is, and where we're headed. I suspect that in 2017 you had a presentation about House Bill 2017 in the legislature, right? And this was a major investment in transportation. I've been in this, working in transportation in this region for a little over 20 years, and I think this is the biggest investment in that period of time. So it was a multimodal strategy that included freeway projects, active transportation, investments in transit operations, and, you know, beefing up our to maintain the rest areas. Really, Travis Brower, the assistant director, refers to it as the all of the above strategy. It also included $5.3 billion of additional revenue. And with that, there were a few policy pieces. And if I were to circle the part that says value pricing, it's right underneath policy, it says accountability, and then it says value pricing, a single line. I like to share that because it can seem like we have this strategy about tolling and pricing instead of building. But it isn't instead of building. And the way I look at this is about making investments in the transportation system, but also making the most out of it, getting the most out of what we have. House Bill 2017, the section on value pricing, directs the Federal Highway Administration to, I wish I had changed the wording there. We are to seek approval from the Federal Highway Administration by December 31st to implement value pricing on I-5 and I-205 in this region. And if the Federal Highway Administration gives approval, the OTC is directed to implement it. So I wish I had changed that, because that looks like we're just going to go do it. And this is going to be a multi-year process. So where we're at right now is a direction to take to begin that process. So I probably should have changed that from implement to pursuing value pricing. But what they said was, you got to use this tool. We want you to use it here. And you're going to do it in a timely way. Here's your deadline. That's what we've been working with. Let's see. The Federal Highway Administration basically prohibits tolling on the freeways, except for a few exceptions. So that's why we have to go to them to get approval or direction. Tolling is a traditional way of funding infrastructure, and in the case where it is used to pay for reconstruction or added capacity, that is an exception where tolling is allowed, and it would be under Section 129, the General Tolling Program. There are two programs that we're looking at where it could be allowed for managing congestion on existing freeways. And one of them is if you convert an HOV lane to an HOT lane, meaning that what currently is only allowed for carpools could be allowed for carpools or somebody paying a fee. And then there's the value pricing pilot program. So just for the terminology, tolling is this overarching term that means that the people who are driving are paying at the time, paying when they're using it. Congestion pricing or value pricing are really interchangeable. I haven't found any distinctions between these terms, but they just mean that you are tolling the user while they're driving, but you're using it in the for the purpose of managing traffic congestion. So one of the things that you'll see is that the rate will change. It'll be a higher rate during the most congested period of the day or whenever demand is the highest. You would not see a toll booth because the purpose is to keep people moving. So that so congestion pricing or value pricing is a subset under tolling. Right now, we're not really limited to either one, but I just want to be clear that there are different things that people might be discussing or concerned about. So with the direction from the legislature, the Oregon Transportation Commission did a couple things. They hired a consulting team, which we have an excellent consultant team with a lot of expertise from around the country and around the world. WSP used to be Parsons Brinckerhoff. They hired staff, including myself. I joined ODOT specifically to do this project. I had been at the city of Portland before this and the city of Tigard, and I was a consultant before that. So I joined ODOT because this is a really exciting project. So then the OTC convened this advisory committee. And so I appreciate that Curtis was a member of that, as well as mayors, representatives from the four counties, TriMed, Rideshare, environmental justice organizations. And we had three members from north of the river, you know, from Washington State. I want to say that this is a very difficult project, politically and technically. So it's important that the Oregon Transportation Commission also had two of their members serve as the co-chairs. So Commissioner O'Halloran and Commissioner Orlando Simpson were with us for the entirety. That helped make sure that we were getting to the right issues that they wanted to discuss, but also it meant that they heard directly from members of the committee and members of the public. They don't have to wait and hear what I come and present to them in a 30-minute briefing. So we appreciate that leadership and engagement. The Policy Advisory Committee at the very first meeting had a charter, and I look at this as the primary request from the OTC to the PAC. So one of the things it says is that the intent of the OTC in doing this work is one, to manage congestion using value pricing to manage traffic demand and encourage more efficient use of the transportation system, and two, to finance bottleneck relief projects. Value pricing can be used, like I was saying, under tolling. And in particular, there was interest from the legislature, in fact, a priority interest, to address a bottleneck on I-205 in the Clackamas County area. So these were the things that were informing the charter for the PAC. Again, two objectives, one to fund projects, another to manage congestion. Those are different, unique objectives, but they can overlap. So those were what was informing us. We were primarily, Section 120 primarily addresses the managing of traffic flow. But both objectives in mind, if we can find a way for them to overlap, that's great. We started this. I had no idea where we were going to end up. I think we do have a way to look at being able to do both, but we didn't know at the beginning. We're still asking the questions and looking. This is the kind of project, like anything that's complex, that in a one-year process, you're going to identify more questions than answers. And that's good, as long as they're smart questions. But fortunately, the charter was specific about the priority. The first thing that we needed from the advisory committee was these questions. Where and what type of pricing concepts would be the right fit for those two freeways? And what kind of mitigation strategy should we be pursuing to reduce the impacts on environmental justice communities, and including low-income communities, and on adjacent communities? So, a little bit about pricing. There are two basic tools that we would be looking at using on a freeway. One of them is a bridge or a roadway toll, and that just means that you're tolling all of the lanes. And then the other is priced lanes, where you operate a priced lane adjacent to unpriced lanes. So those are I call those the building blocks. Early on, we did some high-level analysis, which was really, we called it round one. It was really for the purpose of learning, because we all had a lot to learn Even those of us who have been doing transportation for a long time, if you've been doing it in Oregon, you haven't done a congestion pricing project. And then, of course, our consultants have been doing congestion pricing projects for decades, but they haven't done one in Oregon. So it was a great opportunity for me, and I hope members of the committee and the public and the project team, to learn about the tools. Where are they effective? Where are they not effective? What are the strengths and weaknesses? The consultant team needed to learn more about our politics, our traffic conditions, our growth, our land use patterns, and the geometric conditions of our freeway. Those are all really important considerations. What we learned early on was about just breaking it down, what I walked away with, the price lanes, they are only operationally feasible in an area where you have at least three freeway lanes. Because if you price one and you only leave one unpriced, you really don't have a freeway anymore. You have kind of a rural two-lane highway. So we're only looking at areas with three lanes. There are two parts of this freeway system that have two lanes, two through lanes. One is in the Rose Quarter, and the other is that bottleneck on I-205. Second, freight is typically prohibited from operating in priced lanes. Now, this is the case throughout the country, apparently, in other systems, just because of the operational impacts on those using the priced lane. In the state of Oregon, freight is prohibited from using the leftmost lane, which is where you would expect to see it. So this is a significant issue for people who are really interested in freight mobility as it relates to congestion pricing. Priced lanes tend to generate limited revenue. The consultants gave us a summary table showing us what other systems have generated. And they can often pay for themselves, they can often have great benefits, but they are not, most people are going to use the unpriced lanes as much as possible before they would go into the priced. And so it's generally a lower revenue generator. And then in terms of equity, and this is something we're going to have to work on a lot, these are always trade-offs. It's easy to want to go to a single price lane because it maintains the unpriced lane. And that way folks with low income or folks who are especially dependent on a particular section of a freeway have that option. But the other thing to be aware is that in general, this is in general when I asked the consultant at the beginning of the process, but also what we found in our analysis, the single lane pricing tends to have the highest toll amount, because you're asking it to do more than if you just price them all. And that means that in order to benefit from the congestion pricing program, you have a higher price of entry. One of our goals is to make sure that we are providing benefits to the broadest cross-sections of community. And so we need to think about, if we're trying to provide a better, more reliable transportation system, then we want to then there's some benefit to having a lower price of entry into the better operated system. So it's not an easy just always yes or no answer, but it's just the ways to think about it. So priced roadway is kind of going to be the converse. They do tend to be the highest level of congestion relief, highest revenue potential, highest diversion potential, right, onto the surrounding street system. And here, just the opposite kind of equity trade-off, we did find in the analysis that while there was no unpriced lane option, it had a considerably lower rate. So while everybody would be paying, everybody would be benefiting at a lower price point. These are the kinds of trade-offs that would have to be examined a lot more closely going forward, but these are general kind of fundamental things to be aware of as we go forward. Based on some other findings from that round one, the Policy Advisory Committee considered these five concepts. These were brought from the consultant, and so where you see a green line, it's a single lane toll, and where you see the orange, it's a roadway, so all of the lanes. And I'm going to just say that these really reflect a lot of range. They show small projects. The one on the far right down there, you can probably barely see it, Concept E, is just at the bridge at the Abernathy Bridge in Oregon City. They show very small, system-wide with Concept C. We have two lanes only. We have three that are all of the lanes. We have geographic distribution. Couple of these are for, we cover those three different federal tolling programs. All of them are represented here. This was a good set of viable projects to examine further. So I'm going to skip now to really the outcome at their last meeting. The PAC had six meetings, and on June 25th, they had the final meeting. And a lot of this you're going to see in this report. I'll just say that from my experience working with cities, with elected officials who have to take tough votes, and it was always my job to be nervous on behalf of my mayor that they're not going to be put in a position of supporting something they didn't mean to support. So the way that this report is structured is to really try to capture exactly what they said they would support and what they would not. So some context. And I had earlier on said, this is what we're going to say in the beginning. This is being done by the OTC at the direction of the legislature from House Bill 2017. The Policy Advisory Committee is asked to make a recommendation to the OTC. The OTC remains the tolling authority and will make the ultimate decision. This recommendation is not a recommendation to go forth and toll that section of the highway, flip a switch and turn it on. This is a recommendation to advance this for further work, that this is something worth considering further, and that there is an understanding that there will be more planning, more analysis, development of real mitigation strategies, and that there will be public engagement throughout before the public experience is tolling. There's an understanding that with this agreement, we can move forward. The over and over from the Policy Advisory Committee as well as from the public, what we heard were these concerns. These three statements, I think. The importance of improving transit and other options to make sure that where pricing, that pricing is actually informing a choice, so you have to have a choice available. That we do need to have special provisions for low-income populations. There are a lot of different types, and you know, one of the whole meetings for the Policy Advisory Committee in April was just in small groups workshopping all the different kinds of strategies that can be used. And those are some of the things that are in the attachments to the 156-page version of the report, is all the different strategies and some of the different considerations that people raised. But this was the shared value, and that diversion strategies have to be incorporated, first of all, in the design. Like, where would you end, and you know, what would be the endpoints of a tolling project to make sure that you're minimizing diversion, and what are you going to do to mitigate any negative impacts? So this was presented to the Policy Advisory Committee in June. We asked them to say whether they support, whether they accept, or whether they oppose. We didn't have to go a lot into the definitions of these terms. I guess people understood it, but you know, in some cases people might accept because they're indifferent. In other cases, they might accept because they can stomach it. But they weren't opposed, and so it helped us move forward. I didn't include this in the report, but I wanted to. But we had this quote from one of our PAC members from an email that I think actually captured the sentiment. Sorry, see, don't mean to embarrass you. A strong commitment to enhancing transit options and aggressively mitigating for potential impacts on historically disadvantaged communities should be the first order of business on any option. That was in an email. Do you remember writing that? I can send it to you for proof. But it really did capture, I think, the conversation. People, members of the Policy Advisory Committee were adamant that these cannot be fixes after the fact. These cannot be, you know, an afterthought to fix an oops. It's got to be part of the strategy. And in fact, all along, we had thought we were going to talk about concepts and then mitigations. But I realized people are always worried about those things, and we need to put that up front. And Curtis, if I had found any other good quotes that I could have not seemed to be picking a favorite, I would have included this in the report. I really tried. I should have asked. So that really did, though, I think. I can't imagine there's a single PAC member who would disagree with that statement. So on concepts, we presented a recommendation that had been discussed at their meeting in May and developed over time. And this was, first of all, a recommendation for further study of concepts B and modified E. And so in the report, what those are the roadway pricing on I-5 through the Rose Quarter. And those hash marks there indicate the need to determine the endpoints, that that's a variable. And that would be a pilot project under a value pricing program, the federal value pricing program. And what that means is that it would have specific performance monitoring and reporting requirements. I'll tell you one of the things I know about the value pricing program is that a typical performance metric is that it has to operate at 45 miles per hour or better 90% of the time, or that kind of metric. I'm not sure how much flexibility we will have, but for the Federal Highway Administration, it must improve operations. So this would be a pilot program for that purpose. Down in Oregon City, was analyzed as a bridge toll to see, because remember I told you the single lane tolls won't generate much revenue? So the first idea was, would a single lane toll, you know, there's a plan for a third lane on I-205 in that section. I don't know if you know that, but there is a plan for a third lane, but there's not funding for it. And so the first question was, if we put in a third lane and tolled it, would that generate enough money to pay for it? And the answer from the very beginning was not at all. You would maybe try to pay for its own operations, but it would not pay for the construction. The construction of the bridge reconstruction at Abernethy, as well as that third lane widening, comes to about $500 million. So for that reason, looking under the Section 129 general tolling program for funding infrastructure, we looked at, what about a bridge toll, all of the lanes, would that generate enough revenue to pay for that project? And the answer to that was probably, or at least most. You know, so we're at this stage where we had to make a lot of high-level assumptions. It did include variable rates, so the highest toll would be occurring during the peak period, zero toll at 11 o'clock at night to 4 a.m. So these were some of the assumptions we looked at to say, is this something we should look at more closely? The answer is yes. So we presented that to the Policy Advisory Committee, and the response was most PAC members did accept or support advancing these two projects as pilots for further study. So you can see here, 10 supporting, 6 accepting, and only 2 opposing. So it was a pretty strong degree of support for that. The next was then longer-term implementation, looking more broadly. And so this would toll all of the lanes of I-5 and I-205 throughout the region. There was quite a lot of interest in this. I won't make you wait. Some more opposition, but a lot of support as well. And so the way that this was phrased in the report was that in conjunction with additional planning, because it would take quite a lot of additional planning about impacts on the other freeway system and that sort of thing. But in conjunction with additional system-wide planning, a longer-term, a broader application. And then there were some in the committee who said, just do it. And in fact, I actually heard this in a lot of the public meetings as well. I will tell you, I was very surprised. I was not surprised by the other concepts, but this one did surprise me. But it was there was logic, and that is, in Vancouver, at a business group there, I heard, don't just do a Band-Aid. This is a serious problem. We need a serious answer. Or in Washington County and Clackamas County, we need to be bold. We need to have something that's really going to accommodate growth. So there was a lot of support for this concept going forward, not at the same level, because there was also, this one had a lot of opposition. That's not really surprising, because there's just so much more going on. This really brings in a lot of other issues, but definitely something that the Policy Advisory Committee had a lot of interest in, and I think Curtis is among them. Although then when we asked the members to include letters from their own agencies, and I began to see a little bit more nuance or acceptance that, no, you would make this your goal, but you would still need to do it in phases. So that's just some of the stuff that we'll be able to take to the OTC, and the OTC will be able to provide direction. Remember, I showed you before that there were those two priority questions that the OTC is asking, but other issues come up. And so we identify these other suggestions. One is the need to do additional pricing analysis and planning for the rest of the regional freeway system. That actually is something I heard at the very beginning of this process and throughout. And so I have 10, 6, and 2, 10 supporting and 6 accepting that. Also, the need for capacity, a real capacity strategy as we are growing in both roadway and transit, and that there needed to be a plan for adding capacity in a pricing environment. And then finally, on the topic of how the revenue is used. Now, we heard a lot of ideas about how the revenue should be used. And so I didn't try to capture them all here and vote on all 42 ideas. This really tries to capture the shared perspective of the Policy Advisory Committee to the best that we could, and giving them an opportunity to provide more individualized comment. But right now, any revenue, just so you know, any revenue would be under the guidance of the Oregon constitutional restrictions that it would be part of the state highway fund. So that means it's going to be capital projects in the right of way, in a shorthand description of that. The Federal Highway Administration will also have restrictions on how revenue is used, so we'll be learning more about that. But I think that they're pretty consistent, especially that Section 129. If you're tolling something to build a project, you got to build a project. You can't be doing other things. But what we could get agreement, so there's that. And then in terms of the legislation, Section 129, it did create a congestion relief fund and says that tolling revenue will go to the congestion relief fund. So presumably that would be used to relieve congestion. But there isn't additional guidance in there at this time. But I think that that will happen over time. So I think that these are really reasonable places for the public and for other stakeholders to weigh in. At this point, what the committee did want to say, at least in majority, is that it should stay within the region. Because there isn't anything right now that dictates that it would not go to, I don't know, Burns or Eugene or whatever. So that was input that the Policy Advisory Committee did make at that meeting. Let's see. So my roadmap, we are here. All those green boxes are things that we are doing right now or have done, beginning with 1991, the formation of that value pricing project from the Federal Highway Administration. And then our consultant did this. It's like a game board. There are off ramps. There would be places, you know, we are a long way from any inevitability. There's a lot to be learning. But after the OTC gives direction and we submit a report to the Federal Highway Administration and hear back, what we expect to do are those next items, which include identifying and clarifying what the objectives will be for both or individually or combined Oregon tolling program and how we're going to measure that. Doing more detailed traffic and revenue analysis to see how effective it is at achieving those objectives. And then developing policies that probably dive more into some of those mitigation strategies, which would be the choices, the types of strategies to use, which would be the eligibility. We need to address eligibility. Given that, you know, we have some policy restrictions, how can we make sure that we're really able to mitigate impacts on anybody who should be eligible but who may live in Washington State, for example? Does that fit within our Oregon Constitution? How can we manage that? And we do expect certainly more community engagement and other work as part of the National Environmental Protection Act requirement. So tomorrow, there'll be a special meeting of the Oregon Transportation Commission. Somebody will give, my boss, Mandy, will give a report sort of like this to the Oregon Transportation Commission and take some questions, but the majority of the time will be for public comment. It's 310 Southwest Lincoln Street, the University Place Hotel down by PSU, starting at 4 o'clock, and so you or people you know may want to come and provide comment there, and the public comment period will stay open for a little bit longer. But that's going to be a major milestone. In August, we hope to get direction then from the OTC in order to start writing our proposal to Federal Highway Administration. And that's where we are now.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you. My work is done.
Yes.
Stunned silence.
Stunned silence is right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll take ask if any commissioner wants a presentation on the consent items, which were included in the materials. The consent items were Port of Portland contracting rules revisions and personal service contracts, on-call audiovisual solution services. Okay, hearing none, I'll call for a motion and second for approval of the consent items.
So moved.
Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. And we'll call on Darren Griffin to introduce the first agenda item.
We are here to request approval to award a personal services contract amendment for final design of the CCTV system and Wi-Fi improvements project at Portland International Airport. Today, there are sections of the airport terminal that have limited Wi-Fi coverage and CCTV coverage. This project will enhance customer service for passengers by upgrading the PDX Wi-Fi network, which is one of the most frequently requested improvements by our passengers. It will also improve operations for airlines and port staff. Additionally, the project will upgrade and expand the CCTV security system to increase and improve safety, risk mitigation, security, and operational functions at PDX. Ken Wilhite, Engineering Project Development Senior Manager, is here to present a recommendation to award the Personal Services Contract Amendment.
Thanks, Darren. Good morning, Commissioners. So I'm here to request your approval to award Personal Services Contract Amendment to K2 Security for the CCTV Wi-Fi Improvement Project at PDX in the amount of about $838,000. As Darren mentioned, the scope of this work is to provide final design for the CCTV and the Wi-Fi project at PDX to expand and improve our capabilities and to enhance customer service. This graphic shows you for the in-planning level at PDX where Wi-Fi is being added or improved. It also shows where the access points are being added, and the cameras and the future T-Core columns. You'll notice that the ticketing area is not shaded yellow. That's because that will be addressed during the T-Core project, so we're not putting it in at this time, apart from the small dot you see in the middle. And on the deplaning level, we're adding Wi-Fi capability to the north and south tunnel, the rental car areas, the international arrival hall, and these are some operational areas down below on the south. So for the overall schedule, we're here today for your approval, and we're also waiting for final approval from the AAAC. Once we have that, we will engage with K2 for the final design activities. We're targeting October to be back in front of you for construction, and then we'll go right into installation at that point. Here's the overall budget. We have about $2.2 million in contingency, which is about 20% of the project cost. We consider that to be reasonable given installation in a very busy airport and the risks that we have on the project. This is funded by the Airline Cost Center. And for this phase of the design, the goal that we've agreed upon with K2 is 30% for the SBE participation. And with that, we request your approval of the Executive Director's recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. If hearing none, I'll ask for a motion and second to accept the Executive Director's recommendation.
So moved.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Darren, I think you have the final agenda item as well.
Yes, thank you. This next item requests approval to award a maintenance dredging contract for the port's Marine Terminal 5 at berths 501, 503, and 501 barge slip. The last regularly scheduled dredging at Terminal 5 took place in 2010. Since then, sedimentation has occurred to the degree that maintenance dredging is needed again. Marcel Hermans, Engineering Project Manager, is here to present a recommendation to award the contract.
Yeah, thanks, Darren, and good morning. As Darren said, I'm here to request your approval to award a construction contract for the T5 Maintenance Dredging 2018 project in the amount of approximately $512,000. Terminal 5 is located on the Willamette River, just upstream from the confluence with the Columbia River. Berth 501 is leased to Columbia Export Terminals, also known as Columbia Grain, and Berth 503 is leased to SSA Pacific and is used for shipping potash. The port is responsible for the maintenance dredging at both berths as well as 501 barge slip. And the last regular maintenance dredging at these berths was performed in 2010. So the project will restore 43-foot operating depth at the berth 501 and 503 and 15-foot operating depth at the barge slip. The dredged sediments will be barged to West Hayden Island and offloaded to the port's dredged material placement site there. So here you can see the project schedule. Dredging is scheduled to be performed during the regulatory in-water work window, sometime between mid-August and late October. While the dredging itself is anticipated to take only 12 to 15 days, we allow for a 2-month period in the schedule to minimize impacts to operation and tenants. Shown on this slide, total project budget is set at $1 million, which includes $160,000 of contingency, which is about 19% and is considered reasonable for this phase and risk profile of the project. Because this contract is limited to just one scope of service, namely dredging, and there are currently no SBE dredging firms in this region, the port did not set an SBE goal for this contract. And with that, staff recommends approval of the executive director's recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, I'll call for a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. I guess we are adjourning the meeting. Thank you.